Thank you. That was a very warm welcome. And I'm glad I'm speaking before the Al-Anon speaker. I do not want to speak after the best speaker in the whole universe. So, and I'm glad you have this, what, like 2 or 3 hours to think about how good you really are. Well, enough about Al-Anon. My name's Danny. I'm an alcoholic. I've had the gift of sobriety since February the 18th, 1981. Thank you. I'm from Houston. I'm a member of the Cypress Wood group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Northwest Houston. We meet in the Alano Club, and if you're ever down that way, it's a lot warmer, and we welcome you. And I've lived there about 2 years. Prior to that, I lived in Austin for many years, and I'm good friends with Stephanie and her family, and it's been really good to be here. And I do want to thank Harlan and Zan and the committee for inviting my wife and I to come up. It's Vicki and I have we got married in August this year, and thank you. As my brother would say, he told me to behave because she can do better and I can't. So. So anyway, and I don't know, I didn't really think I was all that sick, you know. I just stare at me, it makes me feel so much better. Anyway, I usually kind of ramble around for about 45 minutes and then get sober, but I'm going to tell you a joke. I've been telling this joke now for 2 years straight, and I promise the tapers each time that I won't tell it anymore. But I can't really let go of it because I like it, you know. And it doesn't have anything to do with recovery that I can tell. But I've kind of got it down, so I tell it over and over. And my wife could do this, I'm sure. Anyway, what happens is this woman walks into a pharmacy and she goes up to the pharmacist and says, "I'd like to buy some cyanide." He said, "What for?" She said, "Well, I want to kill my husband." He said, "Ma'am, you can't walk in here and order cyanide to kill your husband. They'll put us both in jail." And she reached in her purse and pulled out a picture of his wife and her husband in bed together and handed it to him. And he said, "Well, that's different. I didn't know you had a prescription." Motivation. Anyway, I got up this morning and we got to meditate with Howard, which is always a real treat. And it was very interesting. Of all the wonderful things that Howard said last night, the topic of this discussion this morning was why Howard and Pat have twin beds. And so the whole meditation, that was going through my mind. So if you were here last night, I need to re-meditate. Anyway, I'm really grateful. Wow, I just got hit with a wave of emotion. I'm grateful to be sober. I'm grateful to be in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm grateful for my life. And I never was grateful for anything. I mean, gratitude was not an emotion that I felt, expressed, or even thought about. It was just something that you read in poetry while you were in prison. And stuff that, you know, you might get if you ever were able to get enough money. But anyway, I've just been thinking about my life and how wonderful my life is in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm married to the perfect person for me. And I live in this perfect little place in Houston, Texas, and I have this nice business, and I've got all these wonderful friends. And nothing that I was doing early in life indicated that this was going to be where I was going to wind up. I'll just tell you a little bit about my very early life. My mom and dad were married on Valentine's Day, 1944. She was 14 and he was 19. They had me a year later. And so when my mom was 15, my dad was off in the Navy and fighting in the South Pacific, and my mother was 15 years old raising me. And, you know, her mother had just died in a sanitarium in New Mexico from some sort of illness. I think it was beriberi and pneumonia, but she had no family other than my dad and my grandmother on my paternal grandmother, but she was off by herself, and so she's raising me. My mother knows absolutely nothing about life. She's afraid of everything. She came out of the Depression, and anyway, we're just down in South Texas, you know, living one day at a time, and my dad gets out of the Navy, and he comes home, and he has experienced things in the war that grown men, no one should have to go through those things. And when he came back, you know, he had all of these conflicting emotions and, you know, things that I don't even understand that he had to deal with, and he turned to the bottle. And he would drink and work, and sometimes my dad would really be explosive. He was never mean or violent, to at least to me, but he would blow up, and he just, sometimes he would have a lot of fun, but, you know, it just was kind of getting out of hand, and we were afraid. My mom at one point said, if you don't get your, you know, if you don't quit this, I'm going to take Danny and leave. Well, my dad didn't want to lose his family, so he quit drinking altogether, and he just channeled his energy into his work and his family and found another outlet. That was never my experience with booze. I was never able to, once I started drinking, I was never able to say, if I lose you, then I'll quit if that's going to happen. So anyway, my dad gets his act together, and here we are, we're just growing up together. And I'm always a loner. I always just kind of just, you know, observing other people and wondering, what is it that they know and what do they want? And how am I supposed to act so that I'll be okay here? And so I became this almost instant people pleaser, you know, and I would just watch things, and no one could teach me anything because I didn't trust anyone or anything. I trusted only my own thinking, which was not a good thing. By the time I was in middle school, I had two younger brothers. I took care of them. I was very protective of them. But I'm still this loner. And I go to school, and in middle school they would show this film called Duck and Cover. And what that was a movie that you would watch, about 15 minutes long, and it was to tell you what to do in case a nuclear bomb went off in your neighborhood. And I would, you know, I'm already an anxious child. And I'm watching this, and I see this thing go off, and they say, when that mushroom cloud goes off, you get out of your chair, and you open your geography book, because it's the biggest book, and you put it over your head and either get down by your chair or out in the hallway. And I looked at that and I thought, I'm not the best student they have, but I know that's woefully inadequate. After school, we're all walking home, and the guys and girls that I went to school with, they all seem to forget all of that, and they're wanting to play sports and chase girls or do whatever. But I'm not. I'm now very, very concerned about something that everyone's overlooking, and that is that we're in danger here. So I'm walking home. I can't get involved with anything because I've got to protect myself. And I go home and I talk to my dad. I see these igloos up everywhere. Everybody's got a bomb shelter except us, you know. And I asked my dad, I said, you know, where's ours? And he said, oh, that's a bunch of nonsense. Nothing's going to happen in Midland, Texas. And I thought, well, he hasn't seen Duck and Cover. So that started my desire to want to be somewhere else because it wasn't safe at home. Pretty soon I'm just showing up at school, and I'm running away from home, and I'm lying, and hormones set in, and I have this this obsession with women, but I don't know why. And I've got, I stare at a blackboard in school, and they'll write things on it, and it doesn't make any sense to me because I'm deeply depressed, and I can't understand what's going on. I just want to go away. And it wasn't long before after about my fourth or fifth time to run away from home, they captured me and brought me to Big Spring State Hospital and put me in there, and I stayed for a little 3 or 4 months. And when I got out, while I was there, they introduced me to psychotropic drugs and psychotherapy. And I come home, and I'm back home, and I'm there maybe a month or so, and I decide to borrow my mother's car, and I go down to this bar where these guys, it's a drive-in called Day's Drive-In, and I go down there where these guys are hanging out. And, they offered me a drink. And I took the drink because I wanted to fit in. I felt so isolated and alone, and I just would do anything. And I did this throughout my life. I just wanted them to like me. And I took a drink, and before the night was over, I had that sense of ease and comfort that I never even knew I was missing. I just, all of a sudden, everything came into place, and I felt good. I felt that thing that was inside my stomach that was always seemed to be churning, and those thoughts that were just swirling, we just all came into sync and into focus, and I'm doing good. And that night, I got into a fight, I got arrested, I wrecked the car. Everything that externally that could go wrong apparently did go wrong. And the next morning, I'm in a lot of trouble. And all I remember doing was I was laying there thinking, and wiping that vomits off of my face, I was thinking, I am never drinking with those guys again. that was just, to me, made very good sense. They were obviously troublemakers. My folks decided I got out of the hospital a little early, and so they sent me back over there. And as soon as I got there, I attempted to escape, so they put me on this locked ward. So I'm on this locked ward where they give shock treatments, and I'm there, I'm just showing up every day, and I'm watching these guys get shock treatments, and they threaten me with shock treatments if I try to leave. And two guys that were getting shock treatments there were a little older than me, and they were from my hometown, and they became my first close friends. In between shock treatments, we would, weave baskets and, bond, And so, but the more shock treatments they got, the less they were able to interact with me. So I devised a plan on Visitor's Day, and I stole a car from one of the ladies that came to visit her little crazy son. Broke those two guys out, and we made it 40 miles away to Midland, Texas. We picked up two more guys who should have been in that hospital. And we headed for Mexico, about 240 miles away. This is a very exciting period in my life. This is my first gang. I'm their leader. The police are after us. The hospital's looking for us. We're on the radio. I'm very energized. And, we're heading south. We have no money. And we would pull into these little mom-and-pop stores and go in and to get supplies and booze. And what we would do is we'd just create a diversion to get them. And when you're escaped mental patients, creating a diversion is no problem. And we would get our stuff and get in the car and head south. And the further we got from that hospital, those guys' meds began to wear off. It became clear they were in that hospital for a reason. It became increasingly difficult for me to gather my gang up and get them back in the car. And it was sort of like herding cats, God. Well, we made it across the border, and I sold that car to a taxi driver in Mexico. And it was Via Cunha, Mexico. And I sold that car over there for a few hundred pesos, and we make it to the Cadillac bar. And we're sitting down here, and this is when I realize I'm at the end of my plan. I'm a big picture sort of a guy. I can see where we're going. I don't know how we're going to get there, and I don't care about the details. And this has been a problem all my life. So I'm down here at the end of my vision, and we're sitting here in the Cadillac bar drinking, and I'm wondering, what do we do now? And all of a sudden, there's this big commotion, and one of the guys that I'd brought with me was having a psychotic episode, and he killed a parrot that belonged to a girl at work down there, and that started this horrible fight. And so they're called the Federales, and they're after us, and I get everybody out there, and we run for the border. We're going to make it back to Texas. And they caught us on the Mexican side, and we were thrown in jail in Mexico. And that's what I said. And in the big book, in the doctor's opinion, it says that the alcoholic's problems pile up on him and become astonishingly difficult to solve. This is one of those instances. Because I'm not bilingual. I'm not able to communicate to these people at all. I don't know how to tell them I want my mother. I just... But my mom, by this point, I have my dad, my two younger brothers. My dad has a business. My mom has one thing on her mind, and that's her eldest son. She is so hooked into me and what's going to happen with me that she has abandoned in place the entire family. And incidentally, you know, I think about this. I've talked to her about this. It took years after she got in Al-Anon and after I got sober for her to repair the damage she did with my father and my brothers, because she just neglected them. But she couldn't not do it because she was focused on me all the time. She felt guilty. She felt like there was something she could do to fix it. And so, therefore, it shouldn't have been any surprise that she was able to find me in Mexican jail. I don't know how in the world she did it. I've heard her story about it, and I said, "Where did you get that story? I don't remember that at all." And I told her my version. She said, "Honey, some of your fondest memories never happened." But at any rate, my mom comes over and she gets me out of the prison. But she leaves those other guys there because she thinks they're a bad influence on me. Makes me ride back across the border on the hood of the car because I've got lice and all this stuff. And she gets me over there and gets me cleaned up, and they head back to back to Midland, Texas. And she'd brought one of her little friends from church. And they're in this 1955 Mercury with an AM radio. And all the way back, she tunes around until she finds Mexican music and then turns it all the way up. And then what she's trying to do, this is her attempt at aversion therapy. And it really worked. I still hate that music. So we get back to Midland, and I think it was Odessa. We get back to Odessa, and we have a family meeting. And my dad says, "Well, maybe if he just go in the Navy, you know, that he'll grow up in there and he'll be okay." Well, I'm an escaped mental patient. You know, you wouldn't think that the Navy would be interested in that, but they didn't really look that close. So I wound up in the Navy. And I want to take a minute. I've been remiss. I'm sure there are some people here that are new or relatively new to Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you are new here, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Welcome to the fastest growing organization in the world that no one wants to join. And you're welcome to be here, and you belong here. If you have the problem that I have, if alcohol will do for you what it did for me and then begins to do to you what it did to me, you're in the right spot. Just sit right here. And I wouldn't pay too much attention to what you hear from just this speaker tonight. Each of us, none of us at all, are quoting authorities of Alcoholics Anonymous. The big book is the quoting authority on alcoholism and what to do about it. I just tell my story. And a lot of times people tend to base their sobriety off of what so-and-so said. And I just want to point out to you that I'm still an escaped mental patient. You should probably get a book, you know. And if you look around you in this room right now, if you're new, you look around. And what you're going to see in here are you're going to see just hundreds of people who have wrecked their lives. They've wrecked their marriages, their businesses. They've been to prison, mental institutions, lived on Skid Row. They've been absolute disasters. And we would like to guide you into your new life. Again, this is a negative plug for the big book. I'm just telling you right now that you'll go to meetings. I go to meetings all over the country, and people will read how it works. And they'll say, if you want what we have. And I've been sitting in meetings and looked around and thought, I think I already have this. If you want what we have. What's so cool about it, if you own the big book, and if you'll get a sponsor, and that would be somebody who's driving a car that's his. And has like a sparkle in his eye, and he seems to be energized, and he's doing things, you know. He's not just sitting around pontificating, but you'll see him busy. He'll be cleaning coffee cups. He'll be going and seeing people. He'll take time and make eye contact with you. Go up to that guy and get to know him, because he may have what you want. And if you go through that big book with him, you'll start at the doctor's opinion, and you'll just read that in the first four chapters. When you get to that summary in chapter 5, and it asks that question, if you want what we have, you will be able to answer that question. You will know what it is that we have. And more importantly, you'll know what it is that you have. And you can then stand at that crossroads. You can make that choice. Do you want to continue trying to blot out your intolerable existence, or do you want to pick up this simple kit of spiritual tools? So it's your call. But that's all the information it takes a little more time than just picking it up from a speaker. But I highly recommend it. That's what I've had to do. Anyway, I think I joined the Navy about now. I joined the Navy and I was, I got in and I grew big and strong, and I became a CB, that's Construction Battalion. And this is in the early 60s, and we island hopped all over the Pacific. And, you know, my drinking took on mammoth proportions. I had this amazing capacity for booze. I mean, I could put it away. And, but one of the things that was happening to me almost instantly was that I was having these emotional problems. I would drink, and sometimes I would cry. Or sometimes I would be full of joy and happiness, or sometimes I would be philosophical. I mean, but I couldn't quite get it honed down to just, I'm going to be, this fun guy. And sometimes I would get angry and start a fight. Sometimes they would close the bar and I would go to town, even though we have to be at the barracks. And the shore patrol would bring me back. And so I'm starting to get to know the captain, because they have captain's mask, and you show up there because where were you when everybody else came home? And I'm having all of these problems. And I realized that tequila, which I dearly loved, was a big problem for me. And I thought, well, I need to stay away from tequila, and so I'm only going to drink beer. And I would drink beer till I would forget that tequila is a really big problem for me. And I'd have tequila. And so, eventually what happens in my short stint, it was a little under 3 years in the Navy, and what happened is I wound up in Guam. And in Guam, I went out one night, and we just got down to the Club Macombo, and we're having some drinks, and I start drinking with these British sailors. And when the place closes, these Brits offer me, they tell me, they have booze aboard their vessel, and would I like to come over? And I thought, well, we don't do that. We don't have booze at our place. So I went with them, and while I was there taking a drink, I passed out, and while I was on their vessel, they went to sea. And it's like, this is just really getting difficult. And it wasn't hard for them to find out who the stowaway was. All you got to do is just open your mouth. And so they had an American vessel come alongside, and they transferred me to the American vessel, and I'm brought back. And, of course, I'm in a lot of trouble, but I'm also a source of endless amusement for the entire battalion. They can't think of anything that's funnier than what just happened. And I am not equipped at this point in my life with a sense of humor. I have two reactions to do anything that you do that I don't like. I either run away or I attack. I'm not okay with you making fun of me. You can't have a laugh with me even. We can laugh at you, but not me. So what happened is we get back to the States, and I attempted suicide. And I obviously failed and wound up, they said, well, we better check into this guy's history and see what's going on. And they found out that I was an escaped mental patient. So they very quickly, you know, made me an offer. You know, how would you like to be a civilian again? So I got a general discharge with honorable conditions, I got all of the benefits, and I'm released out into the general public. And so I head with a little bit of money to L.A., and I got downtown Hollywood, and there I began to perfect my craft as a low-bottom drunk. You know, I just wandered the streets. I learned to lie, cheat, steal. I learned to sell plasma rather than blood. I learned to hustle people. I don't know how I managed to drink, because I didn't have any money and I couldn't hold down a job, but I always managed to be under the influence. And that's just the way I lived. I lived for days at a time in the same clothes. And I had this problem with blacking out. And, you know, this guy came to me and he said, well, maybe these will help. And he gave me some black mollies. And this was a very powerful pharmaceutical amphetamine. And I took two of them. It didn't do anything. So I took two more. Then I was awake. And I just wanted to go out and talk to people, you know. And I became very friendly. And that became my favorite thing to do. I like to drink whiskey or vodka, take pills, amphetamines, and just make friends. After a while, I'd made so many friends, I had to leave and go back to Texas. Once I'd been up for so many days drinking and doing those things that I was staying at this guy's house, and as I was there, I became convinced that we were being surrounded and spied on. So I went outside and I hid in the bushes for hours to see who it was that was spying on us. After a while, it dawned on me it was me. I've got to get some help. So I went back to Texas and tried to go to work for my dad. My dad had a business, you know, and he was an electrical contractor. And, you know, he didn't know what to do with me. My dad's this really wonderful, quiet guy. I mean, he just, Anyway, my dad is like, you know, when he came back, he was like this big, strong guy that was just really a wonderful guy. And he'd given his all for his country and for his family. And I just adored him. And I was the apple of his eye. I mean, I'm his firstborn. And when he first came back from the war, he would play with me out in the backyard, you know. And I remember once I had this real fond memory of when he played with me. And finally, he just picked me up and held me in his arms. And he just patted my head. And on his bare chest, and I felt safe, and that was just embedded in my being, that I was with my dad and nothing could harm me. But I had this disease. This whole family had something going on here, and I just went off doing what I do, and my dad didn't know what to do with that. They have no tools for dealing with this, so my dad buries himself in his work, and he doesn't understand me at all. He dealt with his stuff by going to work and just trying harder and just ignoring everything. So when his son comes back, I go to work for him. I work for him just a little while, and, you know, I'm so explosive and so much trouble that he has to get rid of me. And I'm downtown at one of the bars called the Office Bar. It became my place to hang out. And I'm down there just hanging out, helping the bar mates, and some guys came in, and these guys would only come out at night, and they had guns, and they had nice cars and girlfriends, and they drank Crown Royal, and I mean, and people really paid attention when these guys came in. I thought that everyone respected them, but really what they did is they feared these guys. and I wanted to be like them. And pretty soon they've invited me to join their little venture. And so what they were doing is they were going out and they were stealing out in the oil field and doing things that, you know, that you guys don't approve of. And it was very lucrative, and, you know, and pretty soon I've got a gun, and I'm drinking Crown Royal, got a girlfriend. She ain't all there, but she's my girlfriend. And, you know, I'm ripping and running, and I think, well, I finally found out what I am. I'm just a gangster, you know. This is everybody's got to do something, and this is mine. And which was good, but then the Texas Rangers showed up, and they arrested us, and everybody, you know, got in a lot of trouble. I had never been in felony trouble with the state of Texas. So what happened for me is I got a probation. And they said, all you have to do is don't drink, don't hang out with those kind of people, live down the terms of your probation, hold down a job, and, you know, this will just be a really tough lesson for you. And it'll be expunged from your record. I said, well, I want to do that very much. I don't want this kind of trouble. So I got a job right across the street from my bar. It was at a service station. I pumped gas. And I would pump gas and wash windshields. And I was doing that one day at a time for 3 weeks. And third week, I'm pumping gas, and I look up there, and that guy's smoking a cigarette and just sitting there staring out the window. And I thought, that guy's an idiot. He can pump his own damn gas. I'm thirsty. I just left the nozzle in his gas tank, and I walked into to the cash register and got an advance. Went across the street to my bar, and I had a drink. And when I came to, I was in Dallas, Texas, which is about 360 miles away. And, you know, I'm there. I don't really have any skills, but I found some guys that were doing the same thing, only the metropolitan version, and pretty soon I'm on first-name basis with Sheriff Decker. And, you know, we're ripping and running, and they're looking for me, and we're doing all these things, and they're starting to stake out my dad's home, and we're watching my brothers at school, and my mom has just got her head down, you know, and she doesn't know what to do. You know, she wants to extract me from this thing, and she can't sleep. She used to say the only time she got a good night's rest was when I was in jail. And I'll tell you, she slept a lot, is all I can tell you. Anyway, I got arrested, and I got 13 five-year sentences, and I was sent off to Texas Department of Corrections. And while I was in prison, I just was in prison. You know, you learn about everything you need to know about being in prison in a couple of days. And so I'm there. I got drunk there a couple of times. I got high there a couple of times. But basically, the consequences of drinking in prison are immediate and severe. So I didn't want to do that. So I would just sit in prison, and for 3 years, I sat there without a program of recovery, without a bottle to treat the way I felt, and all I did was just get sicker and sicker. My mind just spun more stories, and my heart felt heavier, and I felt more isolated. And when I got out, the first thing I did was take a drink. I had no knowledge of myself as an alcoholic. When I got out, though, one of the things I thought is my mom had not taught me a lot because she was very young, but she did say once, she said, Danny, what you need is a wife, a kid, a car, a bank account, job, house, you'll be okay. So I went looking for a wife that had kids, a bank account, job, car, and a house. And I married her, and my mother was wrong. That was the worst 2 weeks of my life. So I left this woman, you know, and man, it was a mess. I left that woman, and I go down to my bar downtown. I'm living in Odessa, and I go down to my bar downtown, and I'm just down there entertaining the troops and drinking and, you know, working on Plan B. And so while I'm in there, there's a lady comes in, and she sits over in the corner, and she's drinking. She's a very attractive woman, and I'm a very compassionate man. And she's over in the corner crying. So I go over to check on her to see what her problem is, and it turns out that she's pregnant, and this is in the 60s, and there was a social stigma attached to being an unwed mother. And so she's pregnant, and she can't go home. Her folks won't have her home like that without a husband. And as she told her story, I got started crying because I didn't have a home to go to. So we hatched a plan, and 3 days later, we were married. I called my mom. I said, Mom, I'm married. And she said, I know. I said, I don't know how you could do it. I just did it. And she said, oh, my God, you have a wife. And I thought, details. I am always I'm always getting tripped up by details. I'm a big picture kind of a guy. So, I thought, well, I'll just go ahead and go on my honeymoon. And so I get in a bus with my new wife, and we get a fifth of whiskey, and we make this 400-mile or so journey to our new home in McAlester, Oklahoma. And when we got there, my father-in-law was there to pick me up. He was driving a chauffeur-driven limousine. He wasn't driving. He was riding in a chauffeur-driven limousine, and he was obviously a man of wealth and power. And I thought, well, I think I may have done something right. And we got in the car and go to his house, and it's a house that's got many, many bedrooms and a big, huge yard. And I go upstairs and pass out in one of the bedrooms. And when I came to, I went down on the veranda to have a cigarette. I looked out across the yard, and I saw his place of business. I had married the warden of McAlester State Prison's daughter. I thought, what are the chances of this? Well, I was very uncomfortable in that relationship. And so I absconded. That means to move in a secret way. I hightailed it back to West Texas, and I get back to my bar, and I'm back in my bar, and I'm just sitting there again planning my life, you know, trying to figure out what I'm going to do if I grow up. And my mom comes into the bar. I don't know how much time has elapsed, but she walks in one day, and I'm sitting there drinking, and she said, come on, we're going to court. And I said, what for? She said, we're going to get you a divorce and an annulment. I said, really? And so I just followed her out, and we got down to the court. We go in there. My mother has this worked out. The judge doesn't get to say anything. The attorneys, the prosecutor, me, nobody says a thing. My mother has it all worked out. She tells him the whole sordid story, tells him what a fruitcake I am, and tells her plan for the whole family. She's going to uproot the entire family and move them to Brady, Texas, where it's dry. They've got me a job. They're going to put the other kids in school down there. It's going to be wonderful. The judge said, good plan. And he gave me a divorce and an annulment. We moved to Brady, Texas. We get down there, and my mother had gotten me a job in a mohair plant. Mohair comes off goats, and my job was to stand by a loom that took this mohair and made it into a rope that coiled it into a barrel. All I was to do was stand there with my scissors and wait for that barrel to fill up about every 20 minutes, and I'd cut it. Move that barrel and put another one there. I'm a binge thinker. That's all I'm doing is thinking. You know, and pretty soon I'm cutting it about every 6 inches. And even an untrained mind would recognize that as passive aggressive behavior. I decided to go back to West Texas. So I hightailed it back to Midland, Odessa. I got back to Midland, Odessa, and, I thought, you know, things are going to be different now. I'm going to change, so I'm going to get married. And I meet a little girl, and this is a girl, you don't usually fall this deeply in love until you get to AA. This girl and I, we were in love with each other. I mean, we couldn't work, you know, we couldn't be apart from each other at any time. We're here, we're drinking and fighting, you know, and we have to be engaged at all times. And after about 3 years of this, I had gotten, my disease had progressed, and, you know, I'm blacking out and acting out, and I'm explosive in my thinking and in my actions. And she had to leave me in order to protect herself because I had become very dangerous to be around. And so she left me, and, you know, and I just went on this big, big drunk. And while I was out doing this and while she was gone, she was killed in a car wreck. And I didn't know what to do with that. I felt guilty. I felt remorse. I felt anger. And I felt self-pity. I probably felt self-pity more than anything I can think of in my whole life. I probably lived with that as a constant companion. It became so familiar to me that after I got sober, I didn't really want to give it up. You know, I wanted to be like you. I wanted to be happy, joyous, and free when I felt like it. You know what I mean? I know some of you guys are like that because I sponsor a few of you. Anyway, With all this going on, I went on this big crime spree. And, you know, the upshot of it is that, once again, you know, they're watching my folks' house, and my dad, who's this, you know, he's this American patriot. He's one of the greatest generation. And he's humiliated. What does he do this? I mean, you know, you mentioned Danny around him, and he says, "Danny who?" And, you know, the police are watching out for him. I'm in the newspaper, and, you know, finally what happens is I broke into a bar, and I was going to burglarize it, but apparently I decided to stay and party. And so they arrested me, and I wound up getting 10 years and sent back to the Texas Department of Corrections. And while I was down there, I made the concentrated effort to change things. I said, my problem is that I'm a thief. That, by the way, is a problem. And I need an education. I don't have an education, so I'm going to get an education, and I'm not going to hang out with these kind of guys, and I'm going to change everything. And I started reading philosophy and encyclopedias and going to counseling and taking class and taking yoga and reading the Bible, and I would do anything except Alcoholics Anonymous. They would come in every Tuesday night, and they would say, "All them winos, AA." And I'd think, "I am not a wino. I am a gangster, and I'm getting better. I'm not going to that thing." And I even had a guy once come by and ask me. He said, "Man, you know, would you like to go with me to an AA meeting?" And I said, "No, I'm on a spiritual journey." And he just looked at me like I was nuts, which I was, and he walked off. But I got out of prison, and you know, I went to work for my dad. And for the first time in my life, I've got my own little place, my own car, my own bank account. You know, I'm holding down a job. I drink only beer and only on the weekends. I have some really long weekends. You know, and sometimes I'll take a drink, and I'll be at work the next day. And sometimes I'll take a drink, and I just won't get there for a couple of days. Sometimes I take a drink, and I have two wives. Sometimes I take a drink, and I'm in jail in Mexico. You know, it's just something that's really kind of got me gun-shy. I need this stuff, and I'm going to take a drink, but when I take a drink, I'm not sure what's going to happen. It makes you a little tense. So I decided I need a caretaker, so I go looking for a wife. And I found her. She was dancing on top of a table at a bar, and I married her, and my life changed. She'd carry out the trash, be gone 3 days. This is at the point I realized I need Al-Anon, you know. So I quit my dad, started my own business, you know, and got my own little electrical business going. I got my wife, and she's a bartender, and I'm doing amphetamines all day and then drinking whiskey with her all night to guard her. And before long, I've got hepatitis, and I'm in trouble. I'm not reporting to my parole officer. My business is a wreck. Everything is a mess. And one of the big problems we had with her was she always wanted to have a boyfriend. And that just really was hard for me to accept, you know. And I guess somewhere in late 1979, she kicked me out of the car. I'd gotten out of the hospital, and I had this swollen belly, and I was sicker than a dog, and she pulled up in front of this house in Midland, Texas, and kicked me out of the car. And what she did is she kicked me out of the car in front of the 710 Club of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I asked her years later, I said, "How did you know about that, that was, I didn't know anything about AA and didn't think you did." And she said, "I didn't know that was AA. I just got sick of you right there." And when you think about that, you think about Norm Alpie's talk, Seconds and Inches. But for Seconds and Inches, none of us would be here. If she could have got sick of me, she probably was sick of me. But she could have acted on that two doors down, and I would have been knocking on some little old lady's door. But as it is, I walked into this meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I walked in there. It wasn't having a meeting. They were playing cards, you know. And I looked in the door, and there was old Francis Newsom was in there, and some other people that Jerry knows. And I said, "Can I use the phone? I need some help." And they were very glad to see me. And they brought me in, and they started talking to me. They offered me orange juice and honey, and I thought, what for? And, you know, they said, well, you're going to get sick as you sober up. And I thought, I'm not sobering up. I don't know what you're talking about here. But, and they started talking to me about a physical allergy and a mental obsession. And if you don't, and one of the things they loved to say in Midland was, if you don't take a drink, you won't get drunk. And I thought, I think that's right. And I thought, well, I just need to use the phone. My wife's got a date with her boyfriend. I think this is going to ruin our marriage. And the guy said, why don't you stay for our meeting? And like I didn't have a car, so I said, okay. So I stayed for the meeting, and they had a call-up meeting. They would call on different people, and they would come up, and they would share from the podium. And the worse their story was, the better you liked it. And I thought, this is a bizarre bunch of people. When it was over, they stood up, they all held the hands and said the Lord's Prayer. And then that place just erupted into laughter. And it seemed to me like the place parted like the Red Sea. And here came a little dour-looking guy with a flat top headed right straight for me. Had two young guys right behind him. I saw him coming, and I thought, oh, hell no. I am not going anywhere with him. His name was Gene Grimes. He's passed on now. And he walked up to me and he said, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. We're going to Baskin Robbins for ice cream. Would you like to go? And I thought, be still my beating heart. There is no way on God's green earth that I'm going to go off with a bunch of geriatrics for ice cream while my wife is off with her boyfriend. That ain't happening. But what came out of my mouth was, sure, I'd love to go. So I'm over there on Wadley Avenue with a melting Rocky Road ice cream, listening to this guy say, if you don't take a drink, you won't get drunk. And I thought, they're beating this horse to death. And this kid that was with him said, let me explain it to him. He said, look, it's not the caboose that kills you, it's the locomotive. And I thought, I should have brought pencil and paper. I'm sure that's going to be very helpful, but right now I've got a lot of problems. And this began my time with Alcoholics Anonymous. I had no concept of Midland having alcoholics to begin with. Except for that guy that walked around town all the time with a trench coat on. But these guys were dressed up nice. I would go to your meetings, and it would make me thirsty. And I would go down to the local 7-Eleven. I remember going down once, and I bought a six-pack of beer. I come out to get in the car, and one of the guys over there waving at me, and I stuck that beer way down. I thought, I wonder why it bothers me that he would see me with beer, you know, and I just thought, well, I'm just not going to buy it here anymore. I'll go to the grocery store. Go in the grocery store, and you're pushing the cart, and look around, and they're just waving at you, you know. I thought, hell, I'm going to have to move. They're everywhere. So I started making my trek between Midland, Austin, and Dallas. And I'm living underground. My wife's living with her boyfriend. I've got hepatitis. I haven't reported to my parole officer. I have reverted to my old behavior, and I'm doing things and have done things that I shouldn't have done. And I'm in a lot of trouble, and I'm living underground, and I'm dying. And I'm going to Alcoholics Anonymous everywhere I go and just hanging out and listening to you guys. And I think, man, I wished I was an alcoholic. I could sure use this. And I got down to Austin. I was living in this old, beat-up, stolen car. I mean, it was such an ugly, stolen car. The guy didn't even want it back. And, I mean, it was just horrible. And I was wearing an eye patch. And I had a full beard. There was nothing wrong with my eye. I just thought I looked really cool, you know. It was sort of a West Texas bling, you know. And, you know, for $1.99, you know, you got to look good. And that's how I'm going to AA, you know. I got it going on, and I'm going to AA, and I'm listening to these people, and I get 30 days and 60 days, and I'm all over the place. And they're, you know, and I know the authorities are looking for me, and my whole world is caving in. And I see myself is ultimately winding up doing life in prison. That's the best I'm going to get to do. And I got drunk on the week before February the 18th. I went out on a drunk, and I came to over in East Austin. I was in the back seat of that old car. I had three old Milwaukee beers, and I was leaning out of the car, puking bile and that green stuff coming out. And I was as sick and as drunk as I'd ever been in my life. But I couldn't have walked to the curb. But all of those thoughts were back, and all of those feelings were back, and nothing made it go away. And, you know, Howard described it last night. You know, it was just the devolution of everything that's good and decent in life was just escaping me, and I was just being drawn down into this place where I was cut off from God and people forever. And I didn't know what to do, and I said, God, I'll do anything if I can get sober. And pretty soon, two guys showed up, and they got me in the car, and I'm riding the hump back to the Northland group. And old John looked around at me, and he said, Danny, if you don't drink, you won't get drunk. I said, how do you do that? He said, well, don't drink right now. And the kid that was with him, the young guy, he said, yeah, and pretty soon you'll have like a minute. If you don't drink right now, then you don't drink right now again, you'll have a minute just pretty quick. And I thought, oh, this is not good. And the guy next to him, the old John said, he said, oh, hell, he said, don't pay any attention to him. He said, listen. Those minutes will become hours. The hours will become days, months, weeks, and years. And you'll find yourself a sober, self-respecting member of Alcoholics Anonymous with a message to carry, lots of friends, and a God of your very own. I said, I want to do that. He said, then do what we do. And I was, at that very moment, I was stricken with this magnificent obsession for sobriety. I wanted to be like you more than anything in the world. I got in there, man, and I lived in the parking lot, and people would take me in, and I could sleep on their couch, and I was at every meeting, and those old-timers saw that I was serious, and I was showing up, and they'd start to talk to me, say, you're doing good, kid, and I loved hearing that. And I got a little cassette player and had Franklin Williams, and I'd ride around and listen to Franklin Williams and Jimmy Williams and Clancy and all these old guys over and over again. I remember going to a meeting, and they said, if you just let go and let God. And all day long I rode around thinking, let go and let God. Let go and let God do what? And that freaked me out. And I'm like, boy, now I'm spinning, you know, and I'm thinking, oh, my God, what have I got? I'm going to get drunk. And I thought, if I can just make it to the meeting, John Henry will know what to do. And I walked into that meeting, and I heard John Henry standing there, and I said, John, I'm an alcoholic. He said, yeah, you are. Come on in this house. And I walked in there, and I joined Alcoholics Anonymous. I got on my knees, and I said the third step prayer, and I wrote an inventory. And I shared that inventory, and when I was through, John said, well, Danny, what's evolved here is a liar, a cheat, a thief, and one of the most self-absorbed, selfish, self-centered men I've ever met. And if you want to live like that, you don't need any help. But if you want to live the way we live, there's more work to do. He said, I want you to go down on Town Lake, and I want you to think about steps six and seven and what you've told me. And I went down to Town Lake, and as soon as my foot hit the ground, I felt this incredible peace and this presence and this power wash over me and through me. And I knew I was in the presence of God of my understanding. That I'd never going to have to drink again, and my life was going to change. And I thought, God, I've done it. I mean, this is it, man. I'm going to go back down there and start chairing meetings at the club. You know, I'm going to straighten those old guys out that don't ever seem to laugh, and it's going to be great, you know. And I became obsessed with Alcoholics Anonymous, man. I mean, I stayed plugged in. I remember one day we were all sitting around, and I was just like, man, we got out of the meeting, and we all talked it, you know, in the meeting after the meeting. It's newcomers. We didn't want any old people around, you know, tainting our thinking. And we were talking about God's will and how we're going to carry this message. And I decided I got to go ask my sponsor, you know. So I go and knock on his door, and he came to the door. I said, Gene. And it was about 11 o'clock at night. I said, what's God's will for me? He said, God told me to tell you to go home and go to bed and meet me in the morning. And I felt very comforted by that. It was very, very nice that God would say something to me. And I was satisfied for that evening. I tell you, I've had such a interesting journey with you guys. I was about, I don't want to forget this because I'm going to tell you that the relief comes for me, or came for me, through going through the entire process. When I was, I just did some of my eight-step stuff, and I got comfortable right where I was. And when I was, before I was 6 months sober, I was, all of the madness was back. And I'm running around to different groups, and I'm just nuts. I even, one time, I just went down to where Bob Miller was, and I said, Bob, what am I going to do? And he said, I get up every morning and look in the mirror and say, I'm a sober, healthy, happy, handsome, and exciting, loving child of God. I said, really? I went out and sat down in that car and tilted that rearview mirror, said my affirmation, and I thought, this isn't working. So I called John Henry. Now, he said, meet me at the club. And I told him about my affirmation, and he said, well, Danny, the reason it's not working is because it's not true. He said, there are people who come into Alcoholics Anonymous who just seem to come in and sit down, and they're able to skate by on half measures. They seem to be okay with being fairly okay. You're not one of those. There are people who have no alternative but to either return to the bottle, commit suicide, or do this thing all the way through. And he said, what's standing between you and the God that you met on Town Lake are the things that are on your eight-step list. I said, well, there's something I didn't tell you. And he said, what is it? I said, in the summer of 1980, this was early 81, in the summer of 1980, there'd been a bank robbery in San Angelo, Texas, and they caught it on videotape. And I was in the area, I'm a blackout drinker, and they're looking for me. And he said, well, you're going to go have to turn yourself in and deal with that. I said, I can't do that. They will put me in prison for the rest of my life. He said, well, then you're going to have to get a new sponsor because you're not going to make it carrying that load. I said, I can't do it. He said, you told me in the beginning when we started this that you were willing to go to any length to have this gift. I said, that's theory. This, they will lock me up forever. He said, well, it's your call, partner. And I sat out in the parking lot and just thought about it all night, and I was petrified. And I finally got honest with God, and I said, God, I can't do it. I don't have the courage. If you want me to do it, you're going to have to help me. And almost immediately, I felt this peace again, and it was just wonderful. And I had this understanding that four walls do not make a prison. A prison is something you carry around on the inside of you. That is true. I have this friend, Rito. We go to prisons together and back in Texas. And Rito says, he says, prison does not turn you, does not set you free. It turns you loose. And that is also true. I'd been turned loose many times. And I had an opportunity to be free, but I may have to lose my physical freedom. And I became willing to do that. And the next morning, I went down to the robbery department. I walked in and told the guy who I was, and he wanted to know where I'd been. And I told him, I gave him my pitch, you know, thought it couldn't hurt, you know, been helping a lot of people. And when I was done, he played that video for me. And it was a tall, thin guy with a beard going from till to till with a gun. And I thought, I am so screwed. I wonder what I did with the money. And second time he played it, he turned around, he looked at me, and he said, the guy I'm looking for wouldn't walk in here. He said, the guy I'm looking for is out there, and we'll find him. He said, but you need to get your skinny butt back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, maybe you can do something about the mess that you've created in life. Now get out of here. I said, I'm in AA forever. That's it. No, baby, this is it for me. I like this stuff. And I joined AA. I mean, I became willing to go to any length. And I've got, as you have, hundreds of stories and thousands of friends and a God of my own understanding. And God, it has been such a ride. And my mom arranged my ninth step with my dad. She got two chairs and set them out, got us two cups of coffee, set us both down and said, go. Stood nearby. By the way, my mother is 29 years in Al-Anon. And Fran Hillen taught her a word that saved my life. She said, here's a word that'll help your whole family. No. She was right. I couldn't believe she learned it. She's really good at it now. Other little things she's picked up, like you'll tell her the whole drama of your life, and she'll say, honey, I don't have a dog in that fight. And you think, who am I talking to? What have they done to my mother? But anyway, I tried to explain that to my dad, and my dad said, you know, son, that's fine. I'm glad you're sober. We love you. Let's get on with life. He wanted to sweep it under the table, and so did I. And for the next many years, I would hear that my dad was proud of me, and I've been an active member of AA. I've had my ups and downs, and I've done all the stuff. I've done things that they said a man with my background couldn't do. I've been places that you can't go. I've owned my own business. I sponsored a deputy sheriff. The judge that sent me to prison the last time told me that if it was within his power to do so, he'd lock me up forever because I was a menace to society and myself. 7 years into sobriety, that man called me one night and he said, my son is in a lot of trouble and I've heard you're doing really good. Is there any way you could come and talk to him? I said, well, yes, I can. So those things don't happen, you know, but here they are happening. Things that you told me that could happen for me if I would do what you do have happened for me. And I think probably lots more to come. I was in my teens in sobriety, and I had a big business and a big wife, and I was living, you know, I was using my uncle's money to help finance my business, Uncle Sam's, and I was kind of stressed out, and I was cutting corners, and, you know, basically I'm running my life, and I'm in a mess, and I got to the point where I just had run my life into the ground. I'm still going to meetings, but I'm not doing the deal, and I had the presence of mind to ask for some help, and I went to a guy, and I went back through the steps, just like Howard said. I went back through the steps, and I started getting free again, and I became willing to face the consequences of my life. And I went back to Midland, Texas to make some amends, and I stayed at my mom and dad's house that night, and I went to a meeting, and I came home about 9:30. My mom was waiting up on me, and I walked in, and I said, is he asleep? And talking about my dad, and she said, he's laying in there pretending to be asleep. And my dad is not this big, strong guy anymore. He's just this, you know, time has worn him down. He's just this wonderful World War II veteran, one of the greatest generation. And I walked in there where he was laying face up in his bed, and I looked down, and I just leaned down, and I kissed him on his old bald head. I said, I love you, Pop. And he took and pulled my head to his bare chest. And he patted my head, and he said, I love you too, boy. He said, I didn't know what to do. I said, me neither, Pop. He said, those people in Alcoholics Anonymous, I hope you'll always remember to tell them how much they mean to us and how much we appreciate what they've done, what you've done for our family. Because you've not only granted me an opportunity to join you in this thing we do and given me a relationship with God, you've done this for my whole family. Just like the alcoholic is a tornado that roars through the lives of others, destroying people in his path. This is a benevolent storm that we create, and it is, it touches everybody that you touch. It's just a wonderful, wonderful way to live, and even if people don't want the benefits of this sobriety, they will get it nonetheless. Sometimes it looks like you're not getting the benefits of this way of life because you have to say no to an immediate gratification, but as you do that, you find that the greater good is attracted to you. And your life becomes much more full and whole. And it's a wonderful, wonderful way to live. I'm married now, by the way. I waited a long time. And I married this gal. She's a registered nurse. Her name is Vicky, and we're having the time of our lives. She loves sobriety and God, and she teaches me lots of things. And she's welcomed me into her family, and now I'm like, I'm a grandparent, you know. Like, it's a little hard for me to get my arms around first, you know, because I've been cool in my mind my whole life. And I thought grandparent wasn't cool, but it turns out that may be the coolest thing I've ever been. You know, got this little grandbaby that comes up to my butt, and just follows me everywhere. And I love that, you know. I would have missed all of these things. I'm not going to go on too much longer because I don't want to wind up in On and On Anonymous. I want to tell you two things and I'll sit down. When I was in 2005, I got a call and it said, how would you like to come to Bangkok, Thailand to share your story? I said, is this some kind of a joke? The guy said, no, mate. He said, we want you to come. I said, when? And he said, you'll be speaking on February the 18th of 2006. I said, are you kidding me? That's my 25th AA birthday. He said, well, happy birthday from God. And I got on a plane and I flew to Japan, which is about 80 hours, it seemed to me. And when we touched down in Japan, I got off that plane and I said, I now live in Japan. I am not getting back on that plane. And they coaxed me back on, said it's only 8 hours over to... We get over to Thailand, and I'm stressing because I want so bad. I always want to do right for you. It's important to me how your heart is and where you work, where you go from here. It's important. And so I'm stressing. I want to do this. It's going to be in Thai. How do you do that? You know, are they going to talk that stuff, and then I'm going to try to, you know, say something, and he, you know, so I'm sitting here freaking out. And I'm sitting outside just before I talk, and I hear this Texas accent. And I look around at this guy, and I said, you from Texas? And he said, yeah. I said, what are you doing here? He said, well, I'm living in Myanmar, which is former Burma. And this is a communist country ruled by a military junta that deals drugs and hates Americans. Good place. And he's living there teaching English, right? And he's got 56 days sober. He's the only guy that he knows of that's even in Myanmar. And he's staying sober by emailing back and forth to a guy in Austin, Texas. And he said, you wouldn't happen to know a guy named Bert P., would you? I said, well, yes, I do. I'm his sponsor. He said, that's the guy that's been helping me. I said, well, God must have sent me here to see if you're actually doing anything. I have no idea God works on a multiplicity of levels at all times. What you think is happening isn't necessarily what's happening. Just go where you're called to go and do what you're called to do. And do it with love in your heart. As a friend of ours, and Bob Boston, says over and over, do things with love in your heart. Do it for the greater good. Remember the gift that you've been given. And offer only that gift. Your opinions, we don't need. We've got some of our own, and they're not that helpful. So, I just want to tell you how much I love you and how much I appreciate what you've given me and my family. I tell you this, the story of my life is still being written, and so is yours. And we deserve a good ending to this story. And there are other people whose stories are being written, and we can weave them into our story. And it's your job to do that. God bless you. I love you. Thank you.